Welcome back to the Daily Drama on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Major criminal justice reform in D.C. has been proposed by a new report released just last week. The report titled Jails and Justice, Our Transformation Starts Today, is the culmination of 2 years of town halls, surveys, and other input. Well, the result, an 80-point plan to address criminal justice reform in the District of Columbia. But what does the report say, and how might reform in the district look? Joining me to talk about that tonight are Emily Tatro, Deputy Director of the Council for Court Excellence, and Patrice Sultan, founder of the D.C. Justice Lab. And you, the listeners, lines are open if you have a comment. If you have a question or some input about this report or this topic at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, you can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Emily, Patrice, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
So, Patrice, let me start with you. You were a part of this process, and there's a lot to go through. An 80-point plan, it's a lot. But can you kind of give me an overview, so that our listeners have an understanding of what this report says and what it means?
It is a lot. There's a lot that needs to be done, and there's an ambitious goal that was set at the outset of this project in terms of how do we actually reverse the harm that we've been causing over the last several decades, and how do we stop the ballooning of our criminal legal system here in the district. And so these recommendations are aimed at trying to cut in half the number of people who are incarcerated in the District of Columbia and based on charges in the District of Columbia and housed elsewhere, as we know so many people are moved outside of D.C. So it is a lot to go through all 80 of the recommendations, but I'd love to highlight a few of my favorites, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Please, give me one, for example.
My favorites is eliminating all statutory and mandatory minimums in the D.C. code. This is something that a lot of states have moved toward, not adding any new mandatory minimums or to repealing several at a time. But we're calling for giving that discretion back to sentencing judges and letting them determine what amount of time and what alternatives to incarceration make sense in a given case, looking not just at the conduct, but at the individual person. So I think that's one that could go a long way. We have some really big mandatory minimums in D.C. that people might not realize are as high as they are. So I think that's huge. Passing omnibus criminal record sealing and expungement legislation is another big priority. And as we see the unemployment rate, and particularly the Black unemployment rate, skyrocketing during the pandemic, it's really important that that happen soon and not later so that people can get back to work. Expanding the use of violence interrupters, police-free schools, raising the age for how we define children up to 21. These are all really really big and bold changes that are being recommended in this report.
Mm-hmm. Emily, from your perspective, who is this report for? Is it for people who may enter into the criminal justice system, people who are currently in it, or for people who are transitioning out of it? Who do you believe it impacts the most?
So, believe it or not, one in every seven adult residents in D.C. has a criminal record. That means that this report is for really everyone who lives here who has been touched by the criminal justice system themselves or who knows and loves someone who has. And we have recommendations here that will prevent people from ever having to come into contact with the criminal justice system by investing in community support. We have recommendations like the ones Patrice outlined that will reduce the number of people that we lock up and the length of time that we put them away for. We have recommendations that will actually take back pieces of our criminal justice system that has been outsourced to the federal government for years and years, and restore local control there so that we have the power to dictate how those operate. And we have recommendations that ultimately do talk about the facilities, and especially after having been facing the pandemic for the past year and having our corrections facilities, our jails here in total lockdown, it's really important that we ultimately also get to the facilities questions and making sure that the people who we do decide as a community need to be locked up for any period of time are being treated safely and humanely and giving a healthy and safe space to grow.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about criminal justice reform in the District of Columbia. A new report just released last week has proposed sweeping change. Want to know what you think about it? Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Patrice, can you give me a little background? What was the genesis of this report? This particular report took 2 years to compile, but it wasn't actually the beginning. This was part and parcel of another report.
Yes. I mean, Emily can speak to this even better than I can. I'm one of the newest members of the task force and came in at the tail end with a real focus on the decarceration committee. But it is it was a tremendous undertaking by the Council for Court Excellence to bring together this many diverse stakeholders.
Hello?
All together on the same page.
Emily, maybe you can answer that question better. What was the genesis of this report? Certainly, criminal justice reform has been something that has been discussed quite a bit over the past two decades, if I can be generous, where it really kind of bubbled up in the conversations of not just in the courthouse, but also in the public square. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, so, there have been a lot of big changes in D.C.'s justice system over the years, the biggest of which was in 2001 with the Revitalization Act, closing Lorton and shipping anyone who we sentenced to prison out to the Federal Bureau of Prisons to serve their sentence. This particular task force was founded because back in 2017, Mayor Bowser had talked about issuing a contract for a new jail, for a public-private partnership to build a new jail facility. And people in the community, advocates, stepped up and said, hey, I don't think we're ready to talk about a jail yet. We need to talk more broadly about what we want our justice system to look like. And a jail should just be one piece of that. So the city, the Office of Victim Services and Justice Grants, granted out money that CCE was awarded, and we were able to put together this task force. And then over two phases, over the last 2.5 years, have worked with our partners at the National Reentry Network for Returning Citizens to do really deep community engagement work. We talked with 2,500 DC residents, about 500 of whom were currently incarcerated in the jail or in prisons, people who have been touched by the system, people who work in the system, people who are neighbors of the jail, people who care because, it's an issue that is close to their heart or because they're a taxpayer here. And we spend a lot of money on our jails. And we took all of this information that we collected from people who live here about what they care about, what crime and safety means to them, what their vision for justice is, and added that to the data that we were able to get from the Department of Corrections and from the Bureau of Prisons about who we currently incarcerate, and then really deeply thought about that in these committees over the course of the 2.5 years to come up with the first report, which set really the vision and the framework for the plan, and now this second report, which is the 80-point 10-year implementation plan.
202-319-7810, 319-7810-202-319-7810. We are talking about criminal justice reform in the District of Columbia. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. We want to hear from you tonight. Let's go to Dwayne. Dwayne calling from Southeast D.C. Thanks for calling, Dwayne. What's on your mind?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest, man. All these killings, all the shooting going on across the city, man, I don't even know how y'all can come up with some criminal reduction act. I want to, like earlier, you the host, you asked about who does this stuff affect. I ain't hear them say nothing about the people who being shot, the people who being, loved ones are being killed. And the second question I want to ask, just now the lady was talking about, she talked to 2,500 residents. I don't think you came over Southeast. Come over Southeast and talk to 2,500 of them. They won't tell you, they won't give you that answer. There's so much crime going on. And so, you know, the city is down to 46% black, right? And so guess where most of them live at? In Ward 7 and 8. And so when you releasing them, you know, like Charles Allen, the council member, he talking about releasing the people, Criminal Reduction Act. And so when you release them, these people are supposed to be helping to curb the shootings across the city. The shootings ain't happening across the city. They happening in two wards, 7 and 8 and 5.
Well, Dwayne, let me give our guests a chance to address that, because I'm sure that you are not alone in your concerns in that regard. Patrice, I'll let you start.
Thank you. You're not alone. That is a sentiment that a lot of people have when we talk about criminal justice reform, and that is the sentiment that drove us to where we are now. It's not as if a group of people in leadership positions sat down and said, how can we lock up as many black people in Chocolate City as possible? We had well-intentioned black people in our mayor's office, in our council members' seats, in our police chief's role, in our prosecutor's role, who led us to one of the highest incarceration rates in the country. And here's what people misunderstood that I think is a good thing to start off with in terms of understanding why this isn't an effort to increase violence or to let people run loose in the street to commit violent crime. If you look at any other society, there's a reason that they don't incarcerate at the rates that America does. It isn't because they're sweeter and more compassionate and, you know, have different sentiments, right? It is evident that at a certain point, when you lock up a certain number of people, it has its own criminogenic effect, that it is causing the crime, that it is destabilizing the community in a way that makes that gun violence that you're complaining of more likely, not less likely, because you have people who are coming home, you have people who are being removed from the community, and you have people who are coming home without any of the kind of stability that they would need to have to be able to succeed, right? So when we look at these million-dollar blocks across the country, the suffering that's happening there, the trauma that the government is inflicting by removing people from the community and locking people up and not looking at alternatives to incarceration, is exacerbating the gun violence that the caller is complaining of on this line. And so nobody who was involved in this Jails and Justice Task Force sat down and said, how do we, you know, lessen the number of people who are incarcerated, even if that means more gun violence? People sat down and said, how do we decarcerate so that we can address the gun violence in the city in a way that will actually work? And what we have to do is push people past wanting to feel safe and start thinking about wanting to be safe and taking the long view of the approaches that it's going to take to get there. And so I very much appreciate the question, and I hope that that helps at least explain how I approach the work. So I wouldn't dare to speak on behalf of everybody else on the task force. I can tell you that nobody wants to see more violence in the city.
Mm-hmm. Emily, before I take a break, I'd like you to respond. You've got about a minute. I'd like for you to respond to what Dwayne was saying.
Well, I really agree with everything Patrice said. And to address the second part of the question about who all the task force talked to, we absolutely connected with communities in Wards 5 and 7 and 8. We specifically set up focus groups and went door-to-door taking surveys in those neighborhoods because we know that most of the people we lock up in D.C. are from Wards 5, 7, and 8, and also most of the people that are harmed by crime, serious crime in D.C. are from Wards 5, 7, and 8. When we looked at the data that we got back from people, we actually looked at where a person lived, what they identified as their race. We looked at whether a person had identified as saying that they had been a victim of crime or as had been incarcerated or both. And we found across the board that we had really broad support for the recommendations that the task force ended up with.
I'm going to take a break, but we want to remind you that you can hear this and every discussion on the Daily Drum via podcast on WHUR.com. It's posted before 9 p.m. every night. Also, don't forget the Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. Download the app from Google Play or the Apple Store. The original Quiet Storm with John Mons is next on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM channel 141, 96.3 HD2 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're continuing our discussion about criminal justice reform in the District of Columbia, a sweeping report released just last week. My guests are Emily Tatro, Deputy Director of the Council for Court Excellence, and Patrice Sultan, founder of the DC Justice Lab. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet me at H. Fisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. I do want to piggyback on something that Dwayne was saying. Even when you look at the report and what it is suggesting to reform the criminal justice system, how do you find balance between rehabilitation and those who really don't need to be ever released on the streets? And I think one of the other things that Dwayne was talking about, and we'll start with Patrice, is that there are, you know, some of the crimes that we are seeing on DC streets are done by very young people. Does the report address balance and also deal with issues to prevent the young perpetrators of violent crime, for example, from entering the criminal justice system?
Yes to both. I mean, the report addresses crime prevention in addition to decarceration, right? That there's an understanding that we don't just dismantle, we have to build what's going to go instead of the system that we have now. And I think what's really commendable about the way CCE set up this task force is that they had working groups talking about the reimagining of the system and not just talking about what people don't like in the system that currently exists. The answer to your question about, you know, how do we strike a balance is that we don't. We give that discretion to judges. We give that discretion to people who are close to each individual case and give them more tools to use to fashion sentences and pretrial release conditions that make sense in an individual case instead of this one-size-fits-all approach. If you look at our current set of criminal laws in the district, you are treated the same way, charged with the same offense, if you engage in a pickpocket and if you engage in throwing someone to the ground, taking all their money and running away. It's the same offense. It's the same offense if you don't pay for a pizza that was delivered late and take it out of the driver's hand. It's all one big felony offense of robbery with no separate degrees, nothing. And so when you have prosecutors then, you know, trying to draw lines based on offense, it's not individuated enough. And they don't know enough about the people there to be able to make more meaningful decisions. So this is a lot of the recommendations you'll see are saying, add that nuance back in. Here are the things that should be considered, and here's who should be making those decisions and when, instead of just wholesale putting a mandatory minimum in place, or wholesale saying we're going to default to incarceration as the solution to everything, and saying what can we rely on that might actually make a difference now that we have years of evidence showing incarceration doesn't do that, and what can we rely on that's not meeting violence with more violence, right? Police and prosecution and prisons being, you know, in their own way, an act of violence, right? So I think it's about wanting to address those harms based on what that individual person needs and what that individual's conduct calls for in that case.
Mm-hmm. 202-319-7810. We are talking about criminal justice reform in the District of Columbia. If you have a comment or a question, join the conversation again at 202-319-7810. So, Emily, one of the big things that this report has tried to address is the jail situation, the incarceration situation. While there is a, you know, D.C., you know, jail, we don't have Lorton anymore, and there are, as you know, and many people who are from the district now, some people who commit crimes in this city don't always serve time in the city. They get sent to other states in federal facilities. How does this report address that issue?
This report recommends that within 10 years, as we build more community supports, cut our jail and prison populations, and build a new facility here in D.C., that we build that facility to be appropriate to hold people who are detained before their trial now, like the current jail is set up, and people who are sentenced to incarceration. So that we can bring everyone home and stop using the Federal Bureau of Prisons within 10 years. One of the things that we really tried to do with this report was to paint a clear picture of who our prisons and jails actually hold. Mm. One of the things about incarceration is that when people are removed from the community, they're cut off from communication. They're out of sight and out of mind. And many times we as a community as a whole don't really think about or have information, even if we do think about, have the information to answer the questions we have. And when we were able to get information from the Bureau of Prisons, you know, it's not a handful of people who end up serving their time elsewhere. On July 4th, there were 3,221 people from D.C. who were serving time in federal facilities as far away as California and Texas, and people are doing a lot of time. Those robbery examples that Patrice gave earlier for pickpocketing or taking a pizza or throwing someone on the ground and beating them up for their wallet. Of the people who are serving robbery charges in prison right now, their average sentence is 13 years. And I think that's something that may be appropriate in some cases and may not be appropriate in other cases. But I think that number is something that we don't think about a lot. we don't know. The people who are serving drug sentences in the Bureau of Prisons have an 8-year average sentence right now. And so this, like Patrice said, the recommendations give us a chance to really individualize how we do things to make sure that the judges are crafting sentences that are appropriate for the offense, and that we can actually bring everyone home to D.C. so that DC can control what type of programming they have, the rehabilitation that's available to them, that, so that they can be in connection with their families and with supportive services in DC. All of these things that we know actually make people more ready to come home, less likely to commit another crime once they are home, and will make DC a safer place for everyone.
You know, it's interesting. This goes back to something else that Dwayne said, and something that one of the two of you mentioned, and I'm not sure which, was that many of the crimes in the city are committed by people who are in Wards 8, Ward 7, and I think it was Ward 6, I'm not sure, but...
Five,
thank you. And so we are, you know, we're looking at an issue not only of the crime, but also the color of the skin of the people who perpetrate these crimes, and the lion's share of them are people of color. What role do you think race will play in reforming the criminal justice system, and how will that be done? Is this about not just sentencing, but is it also about attitudes of judges and prosecutors and parole officers and the like? I know that's a really big question. Emily, I'll let you start with it.
Race has to play a factor in transforming our justice system because it has been the underlying factor in building the system that we have right now. The first jail that ever opened in D.C. was actually on the site where the building museum is now, and was nicknamed the slave pen because it held mostly alleged runaways. In D.C., we over-police black people. They make up 46% of the population here, but they make up 87% of the people we arrest. They make up more than 90% of the people that we put in jail and more than 95% of the people that we put in prison. So the racial disparities get worse at every step along the way. And that means that the people making decisions have to be accountable for that, but really that the systems that we have set up have to be transformed, because it's not just the individual decisions that are resulting in these gross disparities. It's the entire focus of the system.
Mm-hmm. Same question for you, Patrice. From your perspective, what role will race play in reforming the system, and how will that be done?
Well, I think it's important to note at the outset that DC's criminal legal system is entirely black. Emily is right that it gets a little blacker each step in the sort of like system, right? From surveillance to arrest to prosecution to imprisonment. But we're at, you know, 80-90% at every stage. And so as black people are getting pushed out of the city, right, at alarming rates, we know that, the size of our system is staying the same. Mm-hmm. So appreciate how that same footprint of having the most police per capita is weighing on the number of people who remain in the city. And think about the fact that they are only policing people who are poor, right? The reason that our system is entirely black in D.C. is, I don't know if anybody noticed, but we don't have any poor white people in D.C. That's what makes D.C. look a lot different than if you look at states or counties, other places, and try to do a comparison where they have poor white people in their criminal legal system. We don't have any here, so our whole legal system is black. And I think you have to talk about the fact that our city's changing in terms of its demographics, and if we're going to continue to only police black people and only police poor people, then the size of that system and the makeup of that system and the approach of that system has to change in order to ensure that black people are not bearing the entire brunt of what is an enormous weight on their shoulders.
Fascinating. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about criminal justice reform in the District of Columbia. This conversation coming after the release of a sweeping report
last week that details some 80 points of criminal justice reform. So where do we start? I know the report suggests that this process will take at least a decade. But where does this start, Emily? And do you think that in let's get political here? Do you think that this may be able to move faster if DC, for example, is able to achieve statehood? Or do you think it doesn't matter whether or not DC has a sense of political independence or not?
So if we get statehood, that's going to force a lot of this to happen more quickly. But there's so much that we can do before we get to that point. It is a 10-year plan, but there are things that we can start doing tomorrow. And there are things actually that have already been accomplished that we included as recommendations when we were drafting this report and finalizing it in December. But between mid-December and the publication have been done. For instance, we made permanent a law that expanded eligibility for compassionate release that was passed during the COVID-19 emergency to give people who are elderly, who are sick and vulnerable to COVID-19, an opportunity to petition to be released from prison. And we passed that permanently at the end of last year. Patrice earlier mentioned criminal record sealing and expungement bills that would help people, those 1 in 7 adults in D.C. who have criminal records, to help them be more competitive applicants for housing and for employment. And that's something that we could change tomorrow. So there's a lot here, and we have a timeline laid out for all of it, front-ending the policy change in the first 6 years, and then moving into some of the stuff that will cost big money after our economy has recovered from COVID. We think there is a comprehensive plan here that our council and our mayor can and must embrace if we want to change the way that we're doing things here in D.C. and change the outcomes for people and really build a safer city.
As you know, Patrice, there are people who are still behind bars who were arrested and convicted in the District of Columbia for the illegal use of marijuana. And they've been there since before the decriminalization of it. From your perspective, do you think that it's time to let those people out? And is that part of the thinking that comes out of a report like this?
Anytime something is decriminalized or legalized in the way that cannabis was treated in the district, where there's a recognition that the enforcement of these laws did more harm than good, I think that it has to include making sure that people are released from those charges and making sure that people can have their records cleared of that offense, and that whether it's a conviction or an arrest or anything else. I hope that as our sensibilities continue to change about other things that were misplaced priorities or overly harsh penalties, that we'll look at retroactivity and restoration and reparation for the harm that was done as part of the decriminalization and legalization effort as well. So I think it's a great illustration of something that we know was embedded in our legal system for a long time and failed miserably, but it's not the only thing that that we need to revisit. And I'm very much looking forward to the council undertaking a complete overhaul of our criminal code later this year.
You know, a couple of things that we've not really touched on, and I want to really dig down just a little bit in the minutes that we have. One of the things that the report addresses is law enforcement contact. Talk to me, if you can, about that, Emily, and what that reform would look like.
So MPD, like Matrice mentioned earlier, is our local law enforcement agency, but is not the only law enforcement agency that operates locally. It's one of more than 30 law enforcement agencies we have on the ground here. And police are designed to do a very specific thing, right? They're designed to respond to threats. There are people who carry guns. They're not people who have social work degrees or associated with Health and Human Services. Yet we've been relying on them to respond to and address all of these human crises for so many years. So one of the things that the task force recommends is that we actually divest from policing and that we reduce the number of officers that we have patrolling the streets, and that we move the money that we have been investing there into different forms of crisis response. So it recommends, for instance, setting up 911 and 311 to triage so that if someone calls with an emergency that is a mental health crisis or someone overdosing on substances or some kind of public nuisance, that police don't have to be called. It doesn't have to be their job. That we have someone who's specialized in behavioral health responses to respond and actually get to the root of the situation and help the person who's in crisis. Task Force also recommends moving civil traffic enforcement from MPD over to the Department of Transportation. They already do our parking enforcement, and why couldn't it be that someone who does parking enforcement is also trained for speeding violations and other basic traffic enforcement where there isn't some kind of immediate danger? You don't need someone with a gun to do that. So we're really, really trying to rethink how police are used and what can really help get to the root of the issues that face residents every day. And the answer is not always policing.
Patrice, this is a black and white document, and certainly one could consider it a flexible document. But it's one thing to reimagine and to manage things. If you have a thing and you put it in a corner, you wake up the next morning, it's still going to be there in the corner. It's an inanimate object. It's not going to move. But this document addresses people from different social circumstances, different situations, different kinds of crimes and offenses. What do you think would be the biggest impediment to implementing what this document says in its entirety or in pieces?
I think the biggest impediment is the mentality and the misunderstanding about how we keep people safe. The mentality that rewards politicians for standing up and saying, I care about something, by criminalizing something else, by letting this sort of lazy kind of solution generating process take over the way that we solve problems, and saying instead of just giving people credit for adding a new 10-year offense or a new 3-year offense, that we're going to actually hold people in power accountable and require them to come up with better ideas that actually solve the problem. You may have heard a lot about a rash of carjackings,
yes,
right, during the pandemic. We have a 7-year mandatory minimum for carjacking, 15 years for armed carjacking in D.C. If that doesn't tell you that putting harsh penalties on the books is not a way of actually solving a problem, I don't know what will. There's nothing left for the council to do. What are they going to do? Make it a 30-year mandatory minimum and pretend that that solves it? So we have to stop giving them credit for just criminalizing things when we know that that doesn't actually address or prevent the underlying harm. We want to get everybody to collectively start thinking about prevention instead of punishment. And that's the hardest part of this whole thing, is the hearts and minds.
Let's talk about that. And I think you bring up a very important here and now issue of carjackings. And we have seen the police chief, Robert Conti, just last week or the week before, not just saying, yes, this is a problem, carjacking, but he also talked about the things that you can do to stay safe. And you have to certainly be careful about blaming the victim or potential victim. But from your perspective on that particular point, if harsher penalties isn't the answer for carjacking, and you may not have the answer, but if you do, I'd like to hear it. Or things like that, carjacking or any other kind of crime where you believe that deeper, longer incarceration is not the answer.
You know, I don't think it's any coincidence that we've seen rises in certain kinds of crimes in certain parts of the country during a global pandemic when so many people are out of work, out of touch with their support networks, and in a place of great despair. And to suggest that we can just look at our traditional public safety metrics, right? Like, how many police officers do we have? How much are we surveilling people? How much are we locking people up? To solve that, I think ignores those root causes and those harder conversations and harder solutions that we have to develop to make sure people have what they need to not turn to that. And that's not to say that people should default to taking people's cars. That's not the right solution. But but if we're really looking for the causes of this and trying to root it out, I think we have to be honest with ourselves that, you know, the economy and the supports that we have for people matter a great deal to public safety. And we can't really divorce those issues and treat it as if there's just a bunch of bad people around who are going to do the same thing. No, there are trends. There are relationships between how we take care of each other and how we treat each other on the back end. And so I think, you know, you have to really be willing to say, wow, I'm going to take this approach where I don't get to see the immediate impact on how it affects crime, but I know that by making people whole, I'm making people safer in some way.
Emily, what has this report taught you or surprised you about?
I think one of the things that surprised me was how ready people are for this. you know, reforming systems is usually something hard, and you're working to convince people, and certainly, you know, not everyone was on the same page all the time. But we got 26 members of the task force who, you know, some of whom worked for government, some of whom worked on the outside, some of whom were researchers, some of whom were victims advocates, some of whom had been victims of crime or had been incarcerated themselves. We got all 26 people to sit down and look at the research, and look at what district residents were saying that they wanted, and to vote. And we had more than 70% of the task force members vote to approve all 80 recommendations in this plan. And I think that says something. I think that's a recognition that the way we have been structuring our justice system for the last 40-plus years in response to, you know, the scary things that we see on TV and the real law and order mentality, it's an acknowledgement that it's not working. And that people are really ready to try something different. Mm.
Patrice, what surprised you about the report?
That's a great question. Sorry that I wasn't ready for it immediately. I think I am most surprised that the reception has been largely positive, that people are looking at these recommendations, and some people are saying, well, why didn't we do that already, you know? And you know, some of the things that I consider to be, you know, really huge sweeping changes aren't necessarily unpopular ideas. It's just that no one's actually followed through and executed on these things. There are a lot of things that are big and bold that the majority of people want. And I agree with Emily that that getting people on the same page about this proved in some ways easier than I expected when I first joined.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to talk to us about this important report, this very important issue. It obviously does not end here. This is going to be a long process, and you know, hopefully it will help improve, you know, not only the quality of life of the incarcerated and those who are coming out, but also those who would deign to get into you know, this dangerous business of crime and just make the city a better place to live and work. Let us hope that that is the case. Emily Tatro, Patrice Sultan, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, February 16th. I'm Harold Fisher. By the way, we're going to make sure when we post this conversation on WHUR.com tonight that you will have access to the link of this report that you can read at your leisure. Now stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.